When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, welcome back to New Books Network. This is Shu Wan, the host of the new, Disability Study channel. Today I feel very happy to invite Dr. Capri to join us to introduce her newest book, No Good Enough Canada. So my first question today for Dr. Capri is that to invite you to introduce yourself to our audience.
Hello, hi everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Like, my name is Valentina Capurri, and I teach in the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies at Toronto Metropolitan University in Toronto. Former name was Ryerson University, but it just changed last year. And like, my background is actually not totally in geography. I have an MA in geography, but like my expertise is mostly in history. So I have a BA, an MA, and a doctorate in history. So like that's why like in this particular book, like I deal a lot with the history of the Immigration Act, because history is something that is very dear to me.
Okay, thank you so much. So for next question, I'm wondering a reason why you take interest in the promising field of like history of disease and the disabilities.
Yes, so like my interest in disability studies started like mostly because of personal reasons. So I have I'm a person that has like multiple sclerosis, as I clarify in the text as well. And like I went through a lot of challenges. Like I'm also an immigrant, so I went through a lot of challenges when, as an immigrant, I applied to be accepted to Canada. And that's when I became aware for the first time of these provisions that existed in the Canadian Immigration Act concerning like persons with illnesses or disabilities. And that's what like propelled my like my interest to look more into it and figure out what's wrong there.
Thank you so much for your answer again. So now let's turn to your book. So for your book, my first question is that I want to invite you talk about the methodology and the terminology of your book, and the situation of people with mental or physical disability within Western and especially Canadian society.
Yes, thanks for your question. So yes, when I started like doing research on this topic, I use like for a portion of the book, like a lot of secondary sources that are available, more in general on the subject of persons with disabilities and how they are framed within like the Western society and particularly within the Canadian context. So there is a lot of material, excellent material, that has been published throughout the years that elucidate like exactly how persons with disabilities are seen and perceived. However, when it came more specifically to the issue of immigrants with disabilities, I had a lot of more challenges because it's not a subject that has been studied very much. So like in that case, I mostly relied on original sources, on primary sources. So I went through like a document, I researched like the newspaper issues that were published throughout the period I'm focusing on. I look at like a document like published at the government level, like not only like answered, that is like the debate that took place in the House of Commons and Senate of Canada, but also all the different reports that were published by different committees and so on. In terms of the language that I use in the text, I just want to make a brief clarification, because I do understand that, like in disability studies, like we like to make clear that there is a difference between persons with illnesses and persons with disabilities, so they're not necessarily the same. But in my text, I'm using them, the two terms, interchangeably, simply because in the legislation, in the Canadian legislation, they are dealt in as if they are part of the same group. So it's a question just like to make sure like that we understand like the how the legislation evolves through time by considering these two groups are as belonging to the same category. So it's not that I'm not aware that there are differences between persons with illnesses and persons with disabilities, although sometimes the two categories overlap. But like in the particular legislations, they are dealt with as if they are the same category. So that's why I use that kind of understanding.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. So for the next question, I'm wondering about a public discourse developed by federal politicians.
Yes, so I look at the way the public discourse developed by politicians at the federal level. So Canada is obviously a federal country. Like I did not actually have time to look at the provincial level, but it was not really relevant because immigration in Canada is the purview of the federal government. So I focus exclusively on what came out of federal politicians in that sense. And I look at a fairly long period of time, like from 1902 all the way to 2002. So it's a fairly long period of time to examine how these languages evolve. So what is like the discourse that was developed by federal politicians throughout this period of time? And I found it like fairly like interesting, like that, as can be expected, there are very significant changes, like language that was used long time ago, then it became gradually problematic, and after becoming problematic, became unacceptable. So for instance, I found many issues where individuals with disabilities are like defined in very demeaning terms in the initial legislation. So persons with mental disabilities defined like idiots on many, many occasions. So this is obviously a language that would not be acceptable at all today. But this change happens very gradually to time. So like it is a work in progress how like the language it's modified. In terms of like the approach that federal politicians have had to the issue of immigrants with disabilities coming to Canada, my understanding by looking at the document is that their point of view was like mostly based on economic consideration. And so like their assessment of individual coming to Canada is mainly based on the economic potential that these individuals have. And like in the past, for a long period of time, at least until like the 70s, I've noticed that like there was this understanding that persons with disabilities a priori couldn't be good economic subject because they are faulty, they are unemployable. So there is no benefit of accepting these people into Canada. This thing gradually changed in the late 60s, early 70s, also as a response to changes in society. I believe like probably the audience is familiar with the fact that throughout the 60s and 70s, like there were movement, people with disability themselves like took matters in their own hand to like change the perception that society had of them. And these also reflect in the understanding of politicians. So gradually, this like definition of persons with disabilities as like worthless subject because they are unemployable came to be dropped. But in conjunction with this is not that the situation of persons with disability improved. It remained very problematic because at that point in Canada, we started to develop Medicare. That is like a system where like a free visit to hospital and to diagnostic, like visit like for anyone residing in Canada that is a permanent resident or a citizen. And this obviously cost the government because if like people are not paying of their own pocket, it's because the cost is covered by the government. At that point, the argument became no longer that immigrants with disabilities were unacceptable because they were unemployable. It became, well, no, now they are unacceptable because even if they are employable, they are like going to need visits to the hospital, medical care way more often than the regular population. So they are an excessive cost. And the term that was used and actually is used to these days is they put an excessive burden on the system.
Thank you so much for answer again. So for our next question, I'm going to invite you to talk about whether opinion expressed on Ottawa reflect of what public, namely individual and the group who managed to have their views recorded in two major Ontario newspapers, the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star.
Yes, so what happened here is that I wanted to check whether like what politicians were discussing like behind doors in Ottawa had any impact on the way society was perceiving these changes. And because the input of common peoples are not necessarily like available and many of these people are dead, so I couldn't go and interview them, I had to rely on what was contained in like newspapers, not only in newspapers articles, but also like on letters that like people wrote to the editors, to the newspaper to comment on stories that were popular at particular point in time. Now, I am aware that the people that have access to newspapers and have the time to send letters to newspaper is like not necessarily representative of the entire population. But I thought that at least it was enough to give us a general idea of what was the perception in the public. And so what I found out, what I discovered, is that like particularly in the initial period, so in the periods that goes like from 1902, when this system of medical inspections was established, all the way to like the late 70s, early 80s, at the time, like the population was very much behind the government. What I noticed, though, is that like although the people seems to be by and large behind the government, they tend to disagree when particular cases comes to the attention. And I think that's a normal reaction that people may have. If you talk abstractly about persons with disabilities, well, you cannot put a face into it. So people say, yeah, if they are an economic burden, yeah, they should be kept out. But then if you see a particular story, if you are alerted about a specific individual and you get to know through the newspaper that person, people start to feel bad and say, oh, wow, like I didn't know, like this is an individual. Like they start to relate to the individual in specific. And then they start to say, okay, then I don't think like the government is totally right in banning this person. Like this is like a human being, like. So there is this interesting dynamic that goes on through like newspaper reporting, where you see that when the case is very general, when we are talking generally about the legislation, then people say, okay, like the government know better. Like, I don't want to deal with it. It's not my problem. I don't have like a direct interest into it. But then if like individual cases pop up here and there, particularly those cases that are heartbreaking. So if you read that like a family is going to be separated, that like the child is not allowed to follow the parents in Canada because the child has a disability, people feel very emotional. They think, oh no, like that's not right. Like why are we separating families? So that's pretty much what I noticed, like through my investigation.
Thank you so much for your answer. For the next question, I want to invite you to talk about legislative cases of rejected immigrants who questioned the government's action by taking their case to a court.
Yeah, so like this section that deals with the legislative cases is actually, I don't look to the whole period. I mostly focus to the cases that have come up in Canada since the mid-80s. For like a US audience, maybe you're not familiar with it, but in 1985, Canada like brought back the constitution from Britain and added a Charter of Rights and Freedom. And one article, Article 15 of the Charter of Rights and Freedom, provide like non-discrimination against particular equity groups, such as like on the basis of gender, ethnic status, and also disability. So that's what I wanted to find out. If this clause, the fact that persons with disabilities are protected group in Canada, had any impact in how people were perceiving this, this policy that, in my point of view, at least, was discriminatory towards individuals with disabilities, because just because you have a disability, you are not allowed to enter Canada. So I went to look at like court cases that were brought forward during this period. I also want to clarify that mostly I look at federal court cases, and two court cases instead reach the Supreme Court, that is the maximum judicial organ in Canada. I don't know about like cases that were like dismissed before reaching the federal stage, so I'm not aware of how many cases were brought in that situation. What I've noticed, and I was a little bit surprised when I started to do this investigation, is that in many, many instances, actually in all of them except one, the plaintiff, so the people that are bringing the case to court, were not actually bringing the charter into play. So they were not saying like, look, this policy is a breach of the charter because it discriminates against persons with disabilities. They were only actually contesting the decision, saying, look, it's an error because I don't really fit, because I'm not really a big expense, or because my child is not really too costly for the state. So I found that like kind of interesting, the fact that instead of attacking the decision because it was unconstitutional in the sense that was breaching like the Article 15 of the Charter, they take a totally different route and say like, oh, it's not that I'm contesting the legislation per se, I'm just contesting how it is applied to my case, to my individual case. And like, for example, like among these cases, there is one that I just want to mention, if I have a moment, is the De Jong case. This is like an immigrant from the Netherlands, at the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, and he contests the decision because what happened, De Jong decided to immigrate to Canada and bring his family. And the daughter, like the young daughter, was like not accepted because had a mental disability. And the point was like the decision stated, it's going to be an excessive burden. It's going to cost too much to pay for her social services. And the reason why De Jong like opposed this legislation and goes like to the federal court is not like claiming, oh, this is discriminating against a person with a disability. His argument is, as I was mentioning a moment ago, is simply, oh, no, no, like, I can pay. I have enough resources. I can pay for my daughter. So you can keep your legislation. That's totally fine. I'm just contesting you applying this legislation to me in particular, because I do have the financial resources. And there is in the chapter like a whole discussion on whether or not, like, considering like the economic like abilities of immigrants should actually come into play, because it's kind of like tricky at this point. Like, if you say like you can only come if you can pay for your expenses, like it's kind of you are automatically excluding people that have a low economic background that won't be able to cover these expenses. It's also problematic because once you are in Canada, then you are entitled to a free healthcare by the state. So you cannot say, oh yeah, but I signed to pay on my own. Once you are a Canadian, once you are accepted, then like you follow the rules of everyone else. So even if you are a millionaire, you can benefit from like the public healthcare system. So there are all these issues. Another case that I want to mention is instead the one that did not go this route. Went exactly the opposite route is the Chester case, Angela Chester. She contested the legislation not because it didn't apply to her situation, but because she says it's unconstitutional. It violates the Charter of Rights and Freedom because it discriminates against a person with a disability. The Tinder case was an illness because Angela Chester, similar to me, had multiple sclerosis. And like what happens here is I found very, very problematic the final decision reached by the judge. So the judge decided against Miss Chester. So like she did not like win her case because the argument was, well, it's not that we are discriminating against persons with disabilities. So we are not breaching the charter. We are discriminating against people that are an excessive burden on the state, that are like costing the state too much. That I think is very disingenuous as an explanation, because this excessive demand only and exclusively applies to persons with disability and illnesses. So you cannot tell me that is a question of like excessive demand only. It's a question of excessive demand that is only asked vis-a-vis persons with disabilities. For instance, when someone comes to immigrate to Canada, they do not check if the person is a heavy smoker. Now, we know that smoking is bad for your health. So if you smoke heavily, chances are that eventually, as you progress with the years, you will need more medical care. You may develop asthma. You may develop like respiratory problems. You can even develop lung cancer. So it is a big problem. And yet, like, no one asks these questions of heavy smokers. We only ask these questions for people that have either illnesses or medical of disabilities. And that's what I found like quite problematic.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer again. So for our last question today, I want to invite you to talk about your argument that the provision of medical admissibility is unfair and is discriminatory.
Yes, so like this is pretty much connected to the last part of my previous answer. So I think it's very discriminatory because it's a requirement that is exclusively applied to a group of people that have been already discriminated quite widely in Canadian society. And this is like persons with disabilities or illnesses. Again, it's the government will tell you, if you ask, that there is a medical officer that will investigate whether or not your disability is in fact creating a burden. So it's not an automatic exclusion. But that's not the reality. If you look at like how the medical officers proceed, it's automatic that the moment you classify with an illness or a disability, they will not let you in Canada. They will not give you like a permit. just to give like a clear example so people can visualize, I have multiple sclerosis, as I mentioned, and I have a mild form of multiple sclerosis. So like I can function pretty well. Like obviously I have some issues, like I get tired very easily and so on, but this has not prevented me from like having a job in Canada. So I've been in Canada for over 20 years. And like, since I finished my doctorate, I work continuously, like every single year. Like, so it's not that I took time off because I cannot work. It's not that I spend excessive amount of money in the healthcare system, because like I've never spent like time in hospital, for example, for multiple sclerosis. I don't use like social services. And yet, I was automatically banned because someone decided, like in when I applied, that because I have MS, chances are very high that I'm gonna be a burden on the state. That has not been the case. So just to give you an idea of how, like, although they say this is not an automatic exclusion, it's a case by case basis, that's not the truth, because like they do automatically exclude people because they assume that because you have a certain illness or a certain disability, you will create problem for the state. And I think that's very, very problematic. It's not only problematic for immigrants, by the way, obviously it's dramatic for immigrants with disabilities because they are not accepted, but like is also like quite sends a wrong message to Canadians with disabilities as well. So pretty much if you are a Canadian with a disability, what is the message you get from this legislation? That yes, your state tolerates you because unfortunately you are born here. But in reality, were you to come from the outside, they would gladly shut the door in your face. They will not accept you. So it's very, very problematic in that case as well. I also want to clarify, like one last point, like if you give me a moment, is like because people may wonder, well, if you told us that you have a disability and that they have excluded you, how come that you are in Canada? Well, I am in Canada because like whereas they rejected me when I applied as an independent, saying that I was a burden, they had to accept me eventually. Because I applied like as the spouse of a Canadian citizen. And because like the latest Immigration Refugee Protection Act passed in 2002 has established that if you are the spouse or the child of a Canadian resident, a Canadian citizen or permanent resident, they have to accept you. That's why I mean, like I was accepted as the spouse of a Canadian citizen. But otherwise, like had I exclusively applied as an independent, they would not have accepted me into Canada.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer today. I very appreciate it. So at the end of our talk, I want to directly touch our audience. So for listeners, if you have any interest in either history of past and present of immigration, of disability and disease, especially in North America, or you just like me, you are, and or Dr. Kapuri, you are immigrant scholars, I think I highly recommend you consider to read her fantastic book, No Good Enough Canada. It's one of the best books about this topic. As a disability historian, I want to say, and immigrant his scholar, I learned a lot from reading this fantastic research. So at the end of our episode today, I want to repeat the title of this book, No Good Enough Canada. So please consider buying a copy of this fantastic research. So thank you for your listening.